next case on the court's calendar this morning is State of Minnesota versus Daquan Ossie Bradley. We're ready for arguments. When counsel for appellant is ready, we'll give you a moment. Then you can approach the podium and introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent Daquan Bradley. Mr. Bradley is challenging his second-degree intentional murder conviction based both on insufficient evidence and the fact that the trial court applied an incorrect burden of proof when determining whether Mr. Bradley acted in the heat of passion when he committed the killing. I'd like to start this morning with a sufficiency argument, and I'm happy to move on to the heat of passion issue whenever the court would like me to do so. The narrow issue before this court regarding the sufficiency of the evidence is whether this court can reasonably conclude that Mr. Bradley, when he shot the single shot, was doing it with only the purpose of scaring Mr. McGee rather than with the intent to kill him. I can highlight five circumstances that the court found that support this reasonable theory. First, the distance. The district court found that it was between 60 and 70 yards away. While, of course, a very accurate shot from this distance, there is a reasonable inference of guilt, of intent, that he had great aim and that's how he hit him. But there's also a reasonable inference that at that great distance, Mr. Bradley could have shot in that direction with the intent to scare Mr. McGee, but instead hit him.
Before you go further on that, my understanding of the district court's finding is that your client testified the district on that issue, made the claim that the shot was fired with the intent to frighten, and the district court expressly found your client to be not credible on that assertion. There is a basis in the record to support the district court's credibility determination. Why doesn't that resolve this issue?
Because we are dealing with circumstantial evidence, and the district court or the fact finder, if it's a jury, we have no deference to, if this court finds that it is reasonable that he was just trying to scare Mr. McGee, then that you don't look to the district court.
How would we find that it's reasonable that he was trying to scare Mr. McGee if there is an express finding that he was not? This isn't a case where we have a general verdict from the jury and we're left to guess or speculate or reason as to how it reached that verdict. This is a circumstance where we have a fact finder with specific facts found rejecting the theory that you're now asserting. So in the circumstantial evidence test, don't we then say in deciding what are the facts that are found, what are the circumstances proved, that one of the circumstances proved is that your client lied when he said he was intending only to frighten the victim?
Yeah, and our position is that is a conclusion based on all of the evidence, and this court does not give deference to that conclusion.
What's a conclusion?
The conclusion that he was not just trying to scare Mr. McGee when he pulled the trigger.
But isn't that a fact found? I mean, if there's competing evidence and the district court says, I don't believe you when you say you were only trying to scare him, doesn't that become a fact found, and isn't that fact one that is inconsistent with your hypothesis of innocence?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Our position is that is a conclusion, a legal conclusion, on whether or not there was intent or not. And we look at that just the same as if it was a jury's verdict finding a second-degree intentional murder based on circumstantial evidence.
Were you able to find any case law supporting the theory that a district court's finding that a witness is not credible when the witness described the intent in one way or the other, that is a conclusion of law as opposed to a finding of fact? Is there any case law to support that?
I have not. And in this case, it's full of new issues. And I have not.
A new issue. I mean, I think this court, the Supreme Court, courts all over have said that, number one, a credibility finding is a matter, is a finding of fact. And even more specifically, that a mens rea finding, the intent of the actor, is a finding of fact.
Well, if you take a look at the context of, let's say, a first-degree premeditated murder conviction, where a defendant testifies and says, I did not premeditate this murder. And the district court looks at all the evidence and concludes, I don't find that defendant credible. I believe he premeditated the murder because of X, Y, and Z. We can challenge on appeal whether or not that conclusion is the only conclusion that's reasonable.
If you had a jury verdict.
I'm saying a court trial. I'm saying if the court makes that finding.
What is the case you have found that supports that theory that is not a circumstance proved, the court's finding, that is not a circumstance proved in a circumstantial evidence analysis from in a bench trial challenge?
I do not have a case that states that, but I've also never seen a case that says otherwise, that says the state has met its burden of proving an element based on a lack of credibility of a defendant. Mr. Bradley's defense could have been, I wasn't there.
Let me ask a different way. Have you found any cases that stand more generally for the proposition that a district court's specific finding of fact in a bench trial is something other than a circumstance proved in a circumstantial evidence appeal?
No. But I've never seen a case where an element is established solely by a district court finding the defendant's testimony not credible.
But why couldn't we have that if the defendant's testimony goes directly to the element? I mean, in an assault case, if the charge is you inflicted bodily harm and the charge is the defendant hit the person and the defendant testifies, I didn't lay a hand on him, and the judge says, I don't believe you. I'm finding, as a matter of fact, you hit the person. I mean, that's a fact found. Why is it any different if the defendant says, I didn't intend to hit the person, that wasn't my intent, and the district court rejects that? Why isn't that a factual finding regarding intent? I mean, quite frankly, I think what the case law says is intent is generally proved circumstantially because we don't know the person's intent. Here we have a situation where the person told us what his intent was or wasn't. So, I guess one might ask whether it's even circumstantial. Once the defendant gets on the stand and starts talking about his intent, it seems to take us away from the body of case law that says intent is proved circumstantially because we don't know what a person was thinking.
I have two responses. One is, and I believe in this case and in other cases, when the court says the defendant is not credible, it's based on the evidence that the state has presented that shows otherwise, right? So that is the circumstances proves that we're dealing with.
Why?
Is the state's evidence that established.
Why is that? Well, the circumstances proved isn't it based on all of the evidence regardless of who presents it?
It is, but I'm getting to the point of what that finding is, that he's not credible. If the state doesn't offer any evidence, and Mr. Bradley gets up there and says, this is what happened, well, the court's going to likely say, he's credible, because I don't have any other evidence saying otherwise. But if we have a body of evidence that the state's presented, which are the circumstances proved, then that's why he's not credible. It's not because of necessarily just what he's saying, it's because of the evidence that the state presented, and those are circumstances proved that we're challenging. As far as whether this is direct evidence or not, the only direct evidence of intent is if he says, if there's somebody who can testify that Mr. Bradley said, I'm going to kill him. That is direct evidence of intent.
Let me put a slightly different angle on it. The district court did not just find that your client was not credible regarding his mental state, his mens rea, but as the district court, I'll quote the district court, his testimony was neither credible nor plausible. Is your argument the same as to the plausibility, not just the credibility determination?
I think that actually bolsters our argument because I believe that is a legal conclusion of the reasonable possibility test, that we are determining on circumstantial evidence whether it's a reasonable conclusion yes, there's absolutely evidence of intent here, but is there another reasonable hypothesis? And the district court found no. On review, we are reviewing whether this court, if this court can conclude that it's reasonable that Mr. Bradley was just trying to scare him, that is another reasonable conclusion. So the not plausible conclusion, that is not a fact finding. That is, again, finding that the only reasonable hypothesis that the district court found was intent. If I could get back to the circumstances that I believe that support our position.
Let me go right to the finding here before you leave this issue. The district court found that your client's testimony that he accidentally shot Mr. McGee in the back was not credible. So it is necessary then that the district court found that your client did not, as a matter of fact, did not accidentally shoot Mr. McGee in the back. The shooting was not accidental. That the bullet striking, not just the shooting, but the location of the shot, where it hit, was not an accident, that it was intentional.
Right.
You're saying that's a conclusion of law, not a finding of fact.
Our position is that is the court's conclusion of intent. That because...
Well, isn't intent a factual determination? It is an element, but it's also a factual determination.
Well, absolutely. And there has to be facts supporting it. And the court...
But why can't... I don't understand why the facts supporting it can't be... a person got on the stand, took an oath, explained what his intent was and wasn't, and the district court assessed it and said, I conclude your intent was to shoot this person.
Right. And again, our position is that is based on the state's evidence. Right?
What's based on the state's evidence?
That conclusion that he acted with intent. So the state presented their case. You know, it was a shot. It hit him, you know, accurate shot. All the evidence they presented. Mr. Bradley then gets on the stand, and the court believes he's not credible. But what's that based on? It's because the state proved their case.
Well, no, it's based on the fact that the judge got to sit here, look him in the eye, hear what he had to say, listen to the question, and make a decision what his intent was based on what he was saying on the stand.
Right, and I mean,
you seem to be wanting to... I don't see why a judge can't make a determination whether or not someone intended the consequences of their actions based solely on what they say on the stand.
Because...
You're saying that's not allowed, right?
What I'm saying is that is allowed, but the state still has to...
The judge believes he didn't intend it, but if the judge says, no, I don't believe you, I think you intended this, then that conclusion has no meaning.
I believe that conclusion has a meaning, but it has to also take into consideration whether there are any other reasonable conclusions besides that.
The district court, that's the plausibility part. The district court determined, as a matter of fact, that there was no other reasonable explanation. And again, unlike where we don't defer to jurors when it comes to those sorts of things, the circumstances, alternative circumstances. But again, going back to one of my earlier questions, here we have a fact-finding judge that says more than just the defendant is guilty. Have you found any cases that support your theory that the circumstances proved have to be based upon the state's witnesses and not the defense witnesses?
No, except for the basic standard that the state has the burden of proving their case. I mean, obviously, if Mr. Bradley got up there and said, I intended to kill him, that would be a circumstance that the court could rely on for finding intent.
Why, if the state didn't introduce the evidence?
Our position is not whether the state presented the evidence. My argument is that when Mr. Bradley testified, the only reason the court could find him not credible is not only, obviously, it's because of his demeanor, all those things you take into consideration, but it's because of the state's evidence. If the state didn't present any evidence regarding this case and Mr. Bradley testified, I think that the court would believe Mr. Bradley if there was zero evidence in this case. So
there's zero evidence in the case. We wouldn't have a case.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a hypothetical of trying to prove my point of the credibility determination is also based on the state's evidence.
I don't understand the logic, though, that you're getting to it perhaps, but you struck some distinction between the state presents its case, the defendant takes the stand and says, yes, I intended to shoot Mr. McGee in the back. You're saying... It's okay. That is a circumstance proved for the purposes of a circumstantial evidence analysis on review, but it's not a circumstance proved if the defendant gets up and says, I did not intend to shoot him. And the district court says, I do not believe you. As a matter of fact, I find that you're not testifying truthfully and that you did intend. Mm-hmm. Why is one a circumstance proved and the other not?
I can distinguish those two circumstances. The first one is that is direct evidence. So we're not even in the circumstantial evidence world. That would be direct evidence of intent. So our argument on appeal wouldn't be under Al-Nasir or Anderson or any of those cases. It would be, there would be no argument because that would be direct evidence of intent. So it wouldn't be a circumstance proof. We wouldn't go into any of that. The second hypothetical, that is not direct evidence. Him testifying that I did not intend to kill and then the court finding that that's not credible, that is based on the state's circumstantial evidence that the state presented. I've never seen a case where an appellate court has said the circumstantial evidence test does not apply to a court trial when the court makes factual findings that support support guilt. We're still in the circumstantial evidence
world.
Well,
that wasn't my question. My question earlier was, are there any cases where the circumstances proved are anything less than the findings of the fact findings of the district court in a bench trial? And I thought you said, no, you weren't aware of any cases where that is so.
I'm not aware of any cases where that is so. But our position is that it's a legal conclusion of whether he had intent or not. And this court's responsibility is to look at whether there are any other reasonable conclusions. I see my time is out. I believe there are a lot of other reasonable conclusions, but I can respond in rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Jean Burdorf. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney and I represent the state of Minnesota. Whether or not a person intends to kill someone is a fact issue that is decided by the fact finder, whether that is a jury or a district court. A lot of the conversation was about credibility findings and what we make of those. Credibility findings of a defendant or any witness really are not strictly dependent on the evidence that the state has proven. Certainly, if the state presents evidence and a defendant gets up and testifies wholly contrary, that is part of the analysis. But district court judges, as you indicated, Judge Larkin, also get to assess the demeanor of witnesses. And this is one of the reasons that this court is so deferential to credibility determinations, is because the district court judge here acting as a fact finder actually got to see Mr. Bradley get up on the witness stand, give his explanation that he was just trying to scare Mr. McGee, and decided, as a matter of fact, that that was not credible, not truthful, and not plausible. That is a factual finding that this court should defer to. The fact that the district court disbelieved Mr. Bradley's testimony on its face is also a fact that is circumstantial evidence. The fact that he lied, essentially, is evidence that courts can consider when assessing whether the burden of proof has been met. And
going to Judge Larkin, I'm sorry, go ahead, finish.
No, I was just going to give you the citation. It's on my brief at page 13, footnote 6. Those are the cases that I would cite to for that proposition. They're in my brief. So I'm sorry to have interrupted you, actually.
No, I interrupted you. So Judge Larkin raises an interesting possibility, and I'm wondering whether you found any case law either way on this point, that when a defendant testifies, or any witness testifies as to that witness's mental state, and there's only an option A or X or not X, and
okay,
the witness testifies not X, and the district court says, I don't believe you.
Right.
Is that direct or circumstantial evidence?
I didn't do any research on that. I guess what I assumed about that fact pattern, because in Minnesota, if I'm reading Silvernail and the Minnesota Supreme Court's cases correctly, when there is a mixed, so even if it was direct evidence, because other evidence of intent is circumstantial, my understanding of the standard of review is when it's mixed, we still use the circumstantial evidence standard of review. So that isn't the standard of review.
You say mixed, you mean some elements are proved by direct and some by.
Yes.
But in this case, we're talking about the element of intent.
The element of intent.
Why isn't the element of intent directly proved by the district court's, by a witness testifying to a fact that the district court finds, as a matter of fact, is false testimony, that the opposite of the witness's testimony is the truth?
So I'm going to try to answer the exact question you asked. I don't have a case that says that that's direct evidence. What I do have is cases that I cited in my brief, page 13, footnote 6, that say when a defendant testifies or talks to the police and they lie and an adverse credibility determination is made, that is actually evidence of consciousness of guilt. So that's the case law I was able to find. None of those cases talk about whether that's direct evidence of guilt versus circumstantial evidence of guilt. So I can't answer the precise question you asked.
I think case law says that circumstantial evidence requires an inference that is never required with direct evidence.
That's right.
So if a person says, I didn't intend to shoot him, and the finder of fact says, I don't believe you, you did intend to shoot him, mm-hmm. is there any inference necessary in reaching that conclusion or finding?
Well, I think I don't know.
I'm just putting it out there.
Right, and I understand what your logic is. I don't have a case to tell you that's just logically, as I think about that, the inference is you're not telling me the truth. And so the safest way for me to articulate the circumstance proved when use this case. Mr. Bradley said, it was an accident. I was shooting at the van. I didn't mean to shoot Mr. McGee. Okay, that's what he testified to. The judge heard that and said, I don't believe you. The circumstance proved is not necessarily that he intended it, but the circumstance proved is that he wasn't intending just to scare him. Maybe that's a safer way for me to articulate it, is that the circumstance proved is so the way that works into my analytic framework is this.
But if you aren't intending just to scare him, then you necessarily were intending to put the bullet into him.
Right, which is an affirmative finding of intent to kill.
You're saying the inference then and the circumstantial evidence analysis would be you're suggesting there is an inference, but the inference is the step from the district court's finding that you did not do this by accident to the conclusion the implied finding that it was intentional.
I'm not even saying that. I'm hedging my bets. I'm saying I think the safest way to articulate the circumstance proved is really that it isn't an intent to scare. I understand your argument perfectly. I guess I just haven't analyzed it.
It's just a question.
Or the question. I haven't analyzed it at that sort of granular level I think it is a really interesting conversation to have because I just hadn't thought about it as critically as I would like to say, yes, that's exactly what I think you should infer. And in this particular instance, I don't think you have to go there or decide that question to rule in the state's favor because that's one component, but there's plenty of other evidence of intent in this case, which is the beating that happened before, the threat in the hallway from either Mr. Bradley or his companion, the fact that Mr.
You can infer intent from the beating. I mean, the evidence is that Mr. Bradley had the gun during the beating.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how you can infer intent to shoot later on from the shot fired from the window based upon the fact that he had a gun at the time of the beating and the evidence of the beating because I think the opposite would be so if that were what we're relying upon. If he wanted to shoot him, he was there in the apartment laying on the floor with a gun aimed at him. And I mean, I don't know how that supports the.
I think it just shows
that's your strongest.
Sort of. No, I think all of these factors taken together, if you look at each little component to this story, it all adds up at the end to intent to kill. The whole point of the beating isn't that he couldn't have killed him right then. It's that he was angry and had a reason to have sort of a bad motive towards Mr. McGee. It's a very narrow point.
Were you able to find any cases, Mr. Erickson wasn't, I don't know that nothing comes to my mind,
mm-hmm.
where the circumstantial evidence test is applied to a bench trial and the findings of the district court are anything less than, whether it's on credibility or on intent, are anything less than circumstances proved in the circumstantial evidence analysis on appeal?
I have never seen a case, and I did look bench trial cases where the circumstantial evidence standard of review was applied. And I've had a series of three cases before this court this winter and spring with this identical issue in it. I found no cases where the district court's factual findings were not used as the circumstances proved or disproved in a particular case.
Can you think of any legal or logical reason why we would not treat all of the findings of the district court as circumstances proved in this part of the analysis, the circumstantial evidence review?
The factual findings, I cannot. Just as I was going through the evidence, I think that what the circumstantial evidence standard review requires is we look at each component. What the district court, the district court made a determination that Mr. Bradley's behavior before, during, and after the shooting all supported a finding of intent, and I think that conclusion was correct. And again, just the facts, there was the beating, the anger between these two, the threat in the hallway. Mr. McGee leaves the apartment building entirely, and then what Mr. Bradley does is he goes back to the bedroom inside the apartment. He picks up a gun. He carefully kind of navigates his way around the room. He goes to the window. He opens the window, and then he sees Mr. Bradley out there, aims, shoots him once in the back. The factors, and there's plenty of case law in Minnesota that talks about this, a single shot is certainly enough to infer intent to kill, particularly when you hit a vital part of the body. The case that I cited in my brief that I would rely on here is, I think it's probably pronounced Chuan, it's C-H-U-O-N, cited in my brief. That's nearly an identical fact pattern where it's kind of a difficult shot from a distance, single shot, and intent to kill was found.
But counsel, the problem is, if we're doing circumstantial evidence review, the first thing we ask is whether the circumstances proved are sufficient to support a finding of guilt.
Yes.
An appellant's not even challenging that, and that's what you've just described. Now, the harder part is there a reasonable hypothesis of innocence based on those circumstances? So, yes, the circumstances certainly support a finding of guilt. What do you say to the argument that the circumstances also support a reasonable hypothesis that he was simply trying to scare someone?
Well, that is the reasonable hypothesis that was articulated below at the district court and has been argued here. I actually found it very interesting when I was reading the district court's order, because the district court actually applied in its conclusions, applied the circumstantial evidence standard of review in its order.
Decision.
It did. Specifically applied the appellate standard review. And what the district court said is exactly what we've been talking about, which is, I watched you testify. You told me you were just trying to scare him. Your demeanor and the other evidence tells me you are not telling the truth. The circumstance proved is that he was not acting with the intent to scare him. So that it's our position. And the case that I cited in my brief for this proposition is Hughes. It's not exactly on point. It's the closest I could find. When a factual finding is specifically discredited by the district court, I don't think on this court can then use that as a rational inference other than guilt. I will agree with appellant's counsel on this point. I searched long and hard for the Hughes case. That's the closest I could get. There isn't a lot of case law that makes the point I just made particularly clearly in Minnesota. I think there's a lot of case law that talks about credibility determinations are left to the district court, and we give them a lot of deference. I think there's a lot of case law that talks about how we apply the circumstantial evidence standard of review. I had a hard time, and maybe it's just my lack of research skills, but I had a very hard time finding a case that says, when a district court specifically says, I don't believe that you were trying to scare this person, I find that fact is disproved, that this court then cannot use that as a rational inference of guilt. And the reason that that has to be the rule is because to hold to the contrary would completely defeat how we treat credibility determinations from fact finders.
So what you're saying is the Hughes case says a rational hypothesis of innocence cannot be based on a theory or a fact that was explicitly rejected by the finder of fact.
That is what Hughes says. And in Hughes, it was a theory that the district court specifically said, this is not credible. This is not a credible or plausible theory. What I had looked for and was unable to find is a case that says the credibility when a district court makes an adverse credibility determination, that then can't turn into a rational inference other than guilt, or it would totally upend and usurp.
The testimony that was rejected cannot be used to support your rational theory.
That's exactly right. That's the point I've been trying to make. And
what about another? I'm trying to, in my mind, see how the fact of the rejected bumped his arm theory works into the intent analysis. The argument was, Mr. Bradley's testimony was that his arm was bumped by a woman who was actually, other witnesses said, were either standing in the hallway or away, and the district court found incredible his claim that his arm was bumped. That circumstance prove that his arm was not bumped, mm-hmm. bear only upon whether the shot was accidental, or does it also bear upon the possibility of the intent to scare theory?
He did both. He said he was intending to scare him, so he was intending to shoot the bump. I think that IC bumping his elbow was really designed to demonstrate that it was accidental, which again was a testimony he offered and a fact that the district court explicitly rejected.
Right. Those are two different things.
They're two different things.
He's arguing on the one hand, you can find that if you're arguing on his behalf, you might say that the shot was actually accidental. It wasn't even intended to be fired mm-hmm. in that direction at anything. And his theory is expressly slightly different, where he says that it was intentional and I was aiming at something.
Right.
Not that I accidentally shot in this direction. I was actually intending to shoot a van. Mm-hmm. I missed and hit the victim. So I'm wondering whether the two have any interplay at all on this credibility on the question of intent, or whether that finding only bears upon the rejection of his accident theory.
I have a couple responses. I have 30 seconds left, so I'll see if I can do it. One, I think if I recall appellant's brief correctly, they didn't press the accident theory on appeal, so I'd make that point. Two, I think that what they have in common, the accident theory and the scare theory, they're both fact issues, and the district court explicitly listened to the testimony and found Mr. Bradley not credible. I think the analysis works the same way with both of those. I reject your testimony that you were intending to scare this person. I reject your testimony that this was an accident.
Well, I understand that. My question, though, is whether the rejection of the accident claim has any bearing on the issue on appeal, which is the circumstance proved as to intent.
I think the way that it plays into that analysis is that isn't a rational theory other than guilt. We got rid of accident, we got rid of the intent to scare, because the district court, as a matter of fact, found that both of those facts had been disproved through credibility analysis. My time is up. I would just simply ask that you affirm the verdict of guilty for second-degree intentional murder. Thank you for your time.
Just to touch on Judge Ross's last question, Mr. Bradley could have said that he wasn't there at all, and if the court didn't believe that, that doesn't prove intent, right? So the fact that the court didn't believe his theory of bumping his arm, that has nothing to do with the fact that the state still has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he had the intent.
So you don't disagree with the argument that was presented by Mr. At the end by the state, that a circumstance proved is that it was not an accidental bump from accidental shot from a bump in the arm.
The facts do not. Yeah, there's a circumstance prove that it was not a. That he did not, someone didn't bump his arm. And that's because the court specifically found that Ms. Crawford was not in the room. So all of these credibility determinations are based on facts, right? So that credibility determination was, hey, there was no other evidence. There's 10 other people who testified. Nobody put her in that room. Therefore, those facts establish that he is not credible. And that's the same thing with intent. And that's kind of what I've been trying to reiterating, is that the court did not find him credible, which is a conclusion, because all of the other evidence supported otherwise. So those are all of the facts that the state proved, and we are dealing with those now. And we are saying that there's another reasonable hypothesis based on those facts. There was only one shot. If he intended to kill him after he ran across the street, he would shoot him again. The type of gun he used, it was a handgun, a 9mm, shot 60 to 70 yards. There was no scope on the gun. This was not a rifle. If you compare it to the case that the state's relying on, that's 6 to 7 feet in that case, which is 2 to 3 yards. Here it's 60 to 70 yards. So while in that case, it's definitely not reasonable to think that he wasn't intending to kill when he's 6 to 7 feet away, when you're 60, 70 yards, there is an inference of intent, but there's also an inference that he was just shooting in a general direction. And even though his defense at trial was, yes, someone bumped my arm, that's not what we're stuck with here. We're stuck with what the state's evidence is. I also think it's important.
Let me just, there was one other finding. Mm-hmm. Mr. Bradley grabbed Georgia's 9mm gun, walked around the bed to the window, opened the window, and here's the circumstance, the fact, aimed and then fired a single shot. How does the fact that your client was found to have aimed the gun and the district court's finding that your client did not unintentionally shoot at the victim bear on your argument?
Well, I think the court's finding is that he aimed the gun, which we don't, that's fine. He aimed the gun in that direction. We don't know what he aimed at. The court did not find he aimed at Mr. McGee. The court found that he aimed in that direction and then inferred from that intent. Our inference is that from that is 60, 70 yards.
The district court didn't say that your client pointed the gun in that direction, but aimed the gun.
We might be splitting hairs. I think aimed, if she would have concluded aimed the gun at Mr. McGee, I think I might have a different argument. But just aiming the gun, he did. He aimed the gun to scare him.
District court found that he did not aim the gun to scare him.
The court, that was a conclusion by the court.
All right.
That supported the legal finding of intent. And again, we're still in the circumstantial evidence test. There is a case, Peterson, that says that this court reviews court trials the same as they would review a jury trial. It doesn't go into specifics of what we're arguing here, but that is the general idea, is that we would review it the same way. I have 1 minute left. I'd like to briefly touch on the heat of passion issue. We are requesting that this court reverse the district court's amended findings of fact and conclusions of law and remand for a new trial because the court applied the incorrect burden of proof on the state and only required that the state prove that Mr. Bradley acted in the heat of passion when clearly it is the opposite. The state had the burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he did not act in the heat of passion. Under the United States Supreme Court case law in Sullivan, the state has the burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt every element. And if the court is not, or if the jury or the court does not do that, it is structural error that requires automatic reversal under McCoy. So we're requesting that as our alternative remedy to our argument regarding the insufficient evidence. If the court does not have any other questions.
I do have a question.
Yep.
The time lag between the moment of the passion being developed and the shot fired, how much time elapsed?
The court found 1.5 to 2 minutes between the fight and all of this taking place and the shot fired, which is very close in time. And again, for our second issue, we don't need
the heat of passion. Mm-hmm. You're saying the heat of passion was because of the fight or because of the relationship?
Because of the relationship issue and the fact that they were sleeping and this guy came in the room and started
swearing
at them.
So the time that's significant is not from the time of the fight, but from the time that your client had this moment, this sort of lover's triangle,
yep,
revelation.
Correct.
So
I would say that he was provoked at the point when Mr. McGee was cursing at his girlfriend, and that from that point on, that's when the heat of passion took place. So whether it's from that point or during the fight, it just kept perpetuating until he fired the gun. But again, we don't need to reach that issue if this court finds structural error and reverses for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments and your briefing. The case is submitted.